Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for January 13th, 2023. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. Here's our first story. On the front page, there are two large photos. One is of a interstate covered in snow with a large truck, orange truck, sort of plowing the snow off to the side. And beneath that photo is another of a young boy in a heavy coat and hoodie plowing snow out of a driveway. The one with the truck is captioned, "An Iowa Department of Transportation truck plows along Highway 151. On Friday in Fairfax, much of Iowa was under a blizzard warning from Friday, lasting until about noon today." And then the one with the boy is captioned, "Edwin Tomlinson, 4, helps his brothers and sisters shovel the family's driveway Friday in Fairfax." Dangerous winter weather sweeps through Iowa. By Brittany Miller for the Gazette. After the first winter storm of the year passed through earlier in the week, blizzard conditions descended Friday on Iowa with snowfall and strong winds, paired with declining temperatures, spelling perilous travel on roadways. The Iowa Department of Transportation had more than 675 plows on the roads Friday morning. That dropped to around 600 by the afternoon. The combination of wind, snow, and low temperatures made their jobs harder. After plows passed through rural areas, drifting snow quickly flooded some roadways again. Even if blowing winds make the roads look cleared, there still may be a layer of ice present. Road treatments such as brine become less effective in temperatures lower than 0 degrees, keeping roads slick and dangerous. Operators may switch to rock salt in colder weather, but it doesn't stick to roadways as well as brine. Plows will remain on the roads until it's unsafe to do so, said Andrea Henry, Iowa DOT Director of Strategic Communications. Hazards include declining visibility and increases in drifting snow. This continues on to page 10A with two more photos, one of a herd of black cows sort of huddled together in a snowy field, and another of a barn with the American Gothic painted on it, also in the middle of a snowfall. The cow photo is captioned, "Cows huddle for warmth as snow falls Friday in Mount Vernon. Blizzard conditions on Friday into today are expected to be followed by extreme cold. A wind chill watch will be in effect from this evening until Tuesday morning. Wind chills will drop to at least 40 below zero from the weekend into next week, with the coldest accepted early Monday and Tuesday mornings." Snow continues to fall over the American Gothic barn on Friday in Mount Vernon. It's really based on the operator and our maintenance supervisors in those areas, Henry said. If they're getting to a point where they can barely see in front of them, where they can't see where they're at the roadway, then we would pull those plows. But generally, we're going to stay out there as long as we possibly can. As of 4 p.m. Friday, no state plows have been taken off the roads yet. Some counties announced snow plow removal throughout the day, including Johnson County, which planned to pull its snow removal equipment at 6 p.m. Friday. Crews plan to resume normal operations early this morning. The Iowa State Patrol, Iowa DOT, and National Weather Service urged residents to stay off the roads. Snow-covered or partially covered roadways were reported across the entire state. Travel was not advised for about half of the state Friday afternoon, including most of eastern Iowa to Des Moines to southwest Iowa. Most counties were marked as towing not recommended. Several roads across the state were marked impassable by Friday afternoon, mostly in western Iowa. IA-175 north of Des Moines also was deemed impassable due to drifting snow. From 12:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Friday, the Iowa State Patrol responded to 34 crashes. Personal damages were reported in 27, and injuries were reported in 7. No fatalities were reported. The patrol received 355 calls for motorist assist. The number one advice we give you is you don't have to make a trip. Don't if Excuse me. The number one advice we give is if you don't have to make a trip, don't go, Henry said. If you do have to go, use your resources. Make sure you're listening to the forecasts. She recommended keeping tabs on the Iowa DOT's Iowa 511 road condition map and packing a winter survival kit if traveling. A blizzard warning was in effect for a swath of eastern Iowa from Waterloo down to Keokuk. I hope I'm saying that right. Keokuk until noon today. The warning was expanded to northeast Iowa late Friday morning. The most significant travel impacts were forecast to engulf eastern Iowa on Friday night into today, when strong winds up to 50 miles per hour were forecast to cause blowing and drifting snow. A wind chill watch will follow from this evening until Tuesday morning. Wind chills will drop to at least 40 below zero from the weekend into next week, with the coldest expected early Monday and Tuesday mornings. As of Friday morning, between 1 and 4 inches of snow had fallen overnight in eastern Iowa. The Weather Service's Quad Cities Bureau projected Cedar Rapids and Iowa City would see between 5 and 8 inches of additional snow into Friday evening, while area northeast would see up to 4 foot, see up to a foot more. Snowfall was expected to end in eastern Iowa between 9 p.m. Friday and 8 a.m. today, depending on the location. Blowing and drifting snow and travel impacts may continue longer into the morning. Going back to page one, a column to the right of this article is titled "Iowa Dems Unveil New Presidential Preference Mail-in Cards: Revives Caucuses Meant to Motivate Our Iowa Democrats" by Tom Barton for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Monday's Iowa Democratic presidential precinct caucuses will look vastly different than they have in the last 5 decades. Mail-in ballots are replacing realignment and complicated math from previous caucuses. Iowa Democrats will hold their party organizing caucus Monday and later express their choice for president via a mail-in process that began Friday when the first rounds of cards were sent out. As of Friday morning, more than 8,000 Democrats had requested a presidential preference card, according to the Iowa Democratic Party. "And we expect that number will go up," Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart told reporters. "This is the beginning of what will be the most inclusive Iowa caucus process in Iowa history," Hart said. "For the first time, a firefighter or a police officer working on third shift, or a parent who may not have childcare, or a snowbird who is spending the month in Arizona or Florida, and those in our disability community who struggle with home health care can now make sure that their voices are heard in the presidential preference process." The last day to submit a request is 5 p.m. February 19th. Democrats can request a card through the Iowa Democratic Party's website at iowademocrats.org/caucus. The party's new cards will include the names of incumbent President Joe Biden and two long-shot challengers, U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota and author Marianne Williamson, along with an option to remain uncommitted. Completed request forms must be mailed to the Iowa Democratic Party at 5661 Floor Drive, Des Moines, Iowa, 50 50 5 0 3 2 1, excuse me, or Democrats may email them to preference card request at iowademocrats.org. Preference cards must be postmarked by May 5th to count. Results will be announced by party members. This article continues to page 8. Later that same day, on Super Tuesday, when more than a half dozen other states will hold presidential primaries. National Party Rules. The National Party's Rules and Bylaws Committee said it would not accept Iowa Democrats' delegate selection plan unless the party ensured that the postmark deadline for mail-in presidential preference cards in May 5th or later, that is May 5th or later, excuse me, ensuring that Iowa's caucus results couldn't be announced until after the early voting window concludes and other states begin weighing in on Super Tuesday. National Democrats earlier this year reshaped their presidential nominating calendar, booting Iowa from being first in the nation and removing Iowa from the group of early states altogether. The decision followed a chaotic 2020 caucus night for Iowa Democrats when a smartphone app meant to make reporting results easier failed. As a result, the official Democratic caucus results were not reported for several weeks. The debacle compounding existing concerns about Iowa's lack of racial diversity and barriers to participation, state party leaders have been critical of the Democratic National Committee's involvement in delaying development of the app and then demanding additional technology that failed on caucus night. The Iowa Democratic Party put forward the mail-in proposal to make the caucuses more accessible, which was one of the main criticisms. Following the 2020 presidential election, many national party leaders expressed a preference for primary elections over party-run caucuses. Republicans have roundly criticized the decision, saying Democrats have turned their back on Iowa and rural America. National Democratic Party leaders have said they would revisit the presidential nominating calendar for 2028. DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee member Scott Brennan said he believes the mail-in process puts Iowa Democrats in the best position to regain the first-in-the-nation status in 2028, when we will have a competitive presidential process. Motivate our Iowa Democrats. The Iowa Democratic Party still will hold in-person caucuses Monday, the same day as Republicans, but only to conduct party business unrelated to picking a nominee. That includes electing county Central Committee members, determining unbound delegates to the county convention, and to vote on platform resolutions. Hart said she anticipates strong turnout despite the changes. A non-competitive caucus race and a major winter storm expected to bring 40 below zero wind chills. In 2012, the last time there was an incumbent Democratic president, 15,000 Democrats participated in the party's caucuses. The reality is that we know that President Biden is going to be our nominee, Hart said. So our important focus here is to motivate our Iowa Democrats to actually get Democrats to fire up and to get to work, to again do the hard work of getting more Democrats elected. And I think it's been obvious that we have taken that very seriously. Rebuilding party. Hart has been working to rebuild a state party exhausted by repeated defeats and burned by the loss of its first-in-the-nation presidential nominating contest. Iowa Democrats took a beating in the 2022 midterm elections. Iowa Republicans bucked national headwinds and swept all four congressional races in the state for the first time in 50 years. Republicans also expanded their agenda-setting majorities in Iowa legislature. Then to control the governor's office and hold all but one statewide office. Democrats know what's very important, Hart said of participating in Monday's party-building caucuses to counter Republicans, she said, are overreaching by banning school books that depict or describe a sex act and who are not listening to teachers and to students and to the people who are involved in our educational community as to what would actually help our educational process. Hart also dismissed notions that Iowa Democrats would register as Republicans on caucus night to be able to caucus for somebody other than former President Donald Trump in an effort to halt his glide path to the GOP nomination. I really don't see that as a priority of many Democrats, Hart said, but instead their priority, as I mentioned before. We're committed to getting more Democrats elected, and they're more interested in the party-building process than they are in getting involved in Republican politics. On page 8, there is a photo of a man with white hair and a white beard standing, sitting behind a panel with a microphone in front of him and a computer. He wears a suit, and the photo is captioned, "Member Scott Brennan of Iowa speaks December 2nd, 2022, in opposition to proposed changes to the primary system during a Democratic National Committee Rules and Bylaws Committee meeting in Washington." And below this is a sort of sample of the official preference card for voting, which is pretty much what the caption says as well. Going back to page 1, the final article on this page, beneath the winter storm one to the right, in the bottom right-hand corner, is titled, "Bondholders Seek 96% of Mercy IC Sale Proceeds. Attorney Fees Continue to Mount as Mercy Bankruptcy Continues." Article by Vanessa Miller. Iowa City, for the Gazette. Excuse me. Article by Vanessa Miller, for the Gazette, Iowa City. With the $28 million sale of Mercy Iowa City to the University of Iowa just over 2 weeks away from closing, the 150-year-old community hospital's largest bondholders are seeking court affirmation they will get the vast majority of that money, quote-unquote, promptly. Computershare Trust Company, serving as master trustee for bonds issued to Mercy in 2011 and 2018, along with Mercy's largest bondholder, Preston Hollow Community Capital, asked a U.S. bankruptcy judge to direct Mercy to give them $26.8 million of the sale proceeds, either at closing or as soon as practicable following closing, which is expected on January 31st. It is undisputed that the master trustee holds valid, perfected, and enforceable first priority liens. Lions? L-I-E-N-S, excuse me. Upon and security interests in substantially all of Mercy Hospital's real and personal property assets, according to a request filed Thursday evening in U.S. bankruptcy court. In fact, Mercy owes Computershare and Preston Hollow much more than the sale proceeds, $62.1 million, according to court filings, and they are the only creditors with claims secured by property. Mercy also owes nearly 400 non-priority creditors more than $17.3 million in unsecured claims, including $1.8 million to its electronic medical record provider, Allscripts Healthcare, $544,242 to DePuy, D-E-P-U-I, to P-U-I, Thinces Sales, the orthopedics company of Johnson & Johnson, and $268,250 to Des Moines-based Iowa Heart Center. This article continues to page 10. And dozens more hold an unknown amount of unsecured but priority claims, including the Iowa Departments of Revenue and Health and Human Services and Medicaid. Mercy's reported debt totals more include pensioners still owed income through the hospital's unfunded pension plan and plaintiffs who have filed lawsuits against the now bankrupt enterprise. Computershare and Preston Hollow, in arguing for most but not all the $28 million the UI is paying for substantially all of Mercy's assets, conceded that Mercy contributed to a value of $1.2 million to its medical clinics, which aren't subject to the trustee's secured liens. But the bondholders highlighted the fact that Mercy's debt far exceeds its sale proceeds. Throughout the bondholders' request, they reminded the judge that Mercy has validated the amount it owes and agreed the trustee holds secured liens. Moreover, after the closing of a sale, Mercy will have no material operations that require that they continue to hold the collateral proceeds, according to the request. Noting Mercy still will have access to cash on hand and the proceeds of accounts receivable that will continue to be collected post-closing, which may be used to fund administrative and other wind-down expenses. Attorney fees mount. Mercy continues to rack up expenses, including through mounting administrative costs and attorney fees, even as the U.S. trustee continues to protest, filing her fourth objection in late December to another monthly fee application for the Chicago-based law firm of McDermott, Will and Emery. Apparent yet again in the present application is the pattern of a number of attorneys all billing to complete the same tasks, including a number of partner attorneys all billing for the same items and to review every document in the case, acting U.S. trustee Mary Jensen wrote in her objection. Since filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, August 7th, McDermott has billed Mercy for $2.15 million in fees, a total that includes a required 20% holdback of all fees per court order. On top of these post-petitions fee, McDermott reported Mercy paid it $3.14 million between February 28th and August 4th. Mercy also paid it a $761,951 retainer before their bankruptcy petition was filed. The U.S. trustee filed objections to each of the prior applications, which have not yet been heard by the court or otherwise resolved. There are no orders entered by the court allowing payment of any fees. Jensen reported in her most recent objection, resolution of these matters should proceed expeditiously so all attorneys billing in this matter may conform their practices to the expectations of this court. Among her concerns, Jensen reported a growing pattern across the fee applications of McDermott attorneys billing thousands to spend their time applying to be paid those same thousands. In just the month of November, McDermott billed $15,690 for nearly 14 hours spent on fee and employment applications and another $13,494 for 11.4 hours related to the trustee's objections. It appears one attorney is appointed the task of reviewing and summarizing any objections to applications for compensation, but partner attorneys that then also bill to review the objection despite the firm devoting substantial time already to summarizing and drafting responses to the objection, according to Jensen. Given that Mercy has requested a month-long extension to draft a plan for liquidation, Jensen urged resolution of attorney fees destined to escalate. The estate cannot bear the burden of the above objectionable practices continuing on into plan formulation, according to Jensen. Reporting McDermott in November billed nearly 75 hours or $8,292.5. for work on a plan and disclosure statement, which is apparently weeks, if not months, from being filed. For 25 hours of work on the case in November, McDermott partner Felicia Perlman, making $1,850 an hour, billed Mercy $46,620. In comparison, as of December, the average annual salary in Iowa was $49,800. For 94 hours of work in November, another partner, Daniel Simon, making $1,450 an hour, billed Mercy $136,155. $136,155. Nationally, attorneys make an annual average wage of $166,770, according to the Federal Labor Bureau, or $78.74 an hour. 8 of 12 McDermott attorneys who worked on the Mercy case in November billed at a rate topping $1,000 an hour. Among Jensen's concerns were increasing vague explanations of the work McDermott billed for. Simon, for example, billed nearly $3,000 for 2 hours he spent to prepare for a court hearing. Perlman billed nearly 2 hours or $3,330 for analyzing open sale issues and concerns resale hearing and closing issues. Hearing on the outstanding issues are upcoming later this month and in early February. On the second page, is Iowa Today. The largest article is in the upper left-hand corner. It's titled Mother of Nurse Murdered in Prison Attack Filed Lawsuit. Nurse's estate mistakenly closed, causing dismissal of previous petition. Article by Trish Mahaffey for the Gazette. Within the article is a photo of sort of an estate with like a sort of Gresham columns and a balcony right above it, and this like maybe marble. It's got maybe three floors. These sort of, I don't really know what to call them, like columns along the sides of the roof with that are a little bit spiked. And all of that stands in front of a bouquet sort of planted in the ground. It's captioned, flowers line the sidewalk in front of the administration building of the Anna Moses State Penitentiary on March 24th, 2021, the day after nurse Lorena Schultz and correctional officer Robert McFarland were killed during an inmate escape attempt. Schultz's mother is suing prison and state officials over her daughter's death, saying officials had been warned about safety problems at the prison. Anamosa. A lawsuit filed by the mother of a nurse killed by two Anamosa prison inmates in 2021 was dismissed last year because the nurse's estate was inadvertently closed, but a new lawsuit was filed this week. The legal claims are similar to the first lawsuit, but the defendants, employees of the Anamosa State Penitentiary and Iowa Department of Corrections, have been individually named for their role in the gross negligence slash wrongful death petition. Some of the named defendants have retired or are no longer with the prison or the department. Stephanie Schultz, as the mother and administrator of Nurse Lorena Schultz's estate, refiled her lawsuit Tuesday in Jones County District Court against former Anamosa State Penitentiary Warden Jeremy Larson and 10 other officials. The first lawsuit was dismissed because a judge ruled Stephanie Schultz lacked standing, the right to sue, because Lorena Schultz's estate was mistakenly closed August 1, 2022, after the lawsuit was filed in April 2021. The estate was reopened in April 2023. The court also found Stephanie Schultz didn't exhaust her administrative remedies, filing claims with the Iowa State Appeal Board. The new lawsuit states two claims were submitted to the appeal board, and when the board didn't respond after 6 months, they were withdrawn, meaning Schultz had exhausted all administrative remedies under Iowa law and could file a civil action. New petition. The new petition contends the prison and department officials had been warned about safety issues at the prison, including radios not working, understaffing of correction officers, attempted escapes, prison nurses being held hostage, and not enough employees to respond to emergencies. Prison nurses previously, have been held hostage and or attacked by inmates in the infirmary, similar to what happened March 23, 2021, when Lorena Schultz, 50, of Cedar Rapids, and Correctional Officer Robert McFarland, 46, of ELY, were attacked by inmates Thomas Woodward and Michael Ducher as they attempted to escape. They armed themselves with hammers and other tools from the storage area while unsupervised, the lawsuit contends. They were not checked for weapons when they left the storage area and were not required to check out the weapons as part of the prison's industries program, all in violation of prison policy. Schultz died of blunt force head injuries. McFarland also died from being bludgeoned. A prison dental assistant, Lori Mass, and another inmate, McKinley Roby, also were injured. Woodward, then 34, and Dutcher, D-U-T-C-H-E-R, then 28, pleaded guilty to two counts of first-degree murder, one count each of attempted murder and second-degree kidnapping. They are each sentenced to life in prison without parole. The lawsuit claims prison and state officials knew these safety violations were in dereliction of their duties, D-E-R-E-L-I-C-T-I-O-N, and failed to set up appropriate safety policies and procedures regarding tool control, camera systems, communication systems, workplace violence prevention, and security inspections. The officials knew some of these issues violated Iowa's Occupational Safety and Health Act, including those that could likely cause death and serious physical harm to employees, because OSHA had previously cited the prison for violations, according to the lawsuit. Defendants knew that these safety violations made it probable that an employee would be injured or killed, the suit said. Defendants consciously failed to take any action to rectify these issues and exhibited willful and wanton disregard for the safety of employees and inmates at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. Named defendants. The prison or Department of Corrections employees named as defendants in the 11 gross negligence slash wrongful death legal claims are Jeremy Larson, former Anamosa State Penitentiary Warden, William Spurfsledge, the department's former Deputy Director of Institutional Operations, Michael Henrici, Warden of Iowa Medical and Classification Center, Robert Hartig, Anamosa Prisons Correctional Supervisor, Dan Clark, former Deputy Director of Iowa Prison Industries, who retired in March, Beth Skinner, Director, Iowa Department of Corrections, Tracy Deesh, department's treatment director, Chad Kirker, department's associate warden of administration, Jerome Greenfield, department's health services administrator, Samantha Tucker, employed by the state, job title unknown at time of attacks, Sarah Holder, department's training director. The suit contends each defendant failed to provide a safe working environment, sufficient staffing, training, and safety protocol, and failed to screen inmates for the prison industry's program, follow safety policies to prevent inmate attacks of employees, and respond to their complaints. After the attack, Larson was reassigned to another corrections department role. The Iowa legislature also approved $20 million in additional money for the corrections department, with a large share to be used to fill vacancies. The department also hired a consultant to undertake a 7-month security review of Iowa's prison system following the murders. While the majority of the report was never released to the public, a summary showed crowding and challenges in recruiting and retaining staff created potential security risks in Iowa's 9 prisons. Before we go any further, I would like to say you are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. On the to the right of this article on the second page is one along the left on the right side titled "Anamosa Boy Critically Injured When Stuck While Sledding." Please keep praying for our big-hearted, beautiful boy, his mother writes online. Article by Emily Anderson for the Gazette. Anamosa. A boy sledding at home during a snow day this week was critically injured when he slid into the road and was struck by a sport utility vehicle, according to the Iowa State Patrol in an online report from a family friend. The child's name and age was withheld from the State Patrol report, but he was identified on a GoFundMe page as Adam McWerter. The fundraising page has raised over $25,000 for the family by Friday afternoon. According to the State Patrol, the child was sledding about 11:30 a.m. Wednesday in the 13,000 block of Buffalo Road in Anamosa when the sled picked up speed during going downhill and slid into the road. Troopers said the sled crossed in front of a northbound 2008 GMC Envoy, which struck the child. The patrol withheld the name and age of the Envoy's driver and said the crash remained under investigation. According to the GoFundMe page started Thursday by a friend of Adam's mother, Amanda McWerter, the boy's heart stopped after the crash but was restarted by paramedics. He was taken to the Jones Regional Hospital and then transferred to the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. Adam has several broken bones and some bleeding in his brain and lungs, according to the GoFundMe report. His heart was beating on its own, and he's had an increase in brain activity since the crash, but still has a long road to recovery, a Friday update said. He has attempted to take a few breaths on his own, but that is very sporadic. He is heavily sedated at the point, and monitoring his temperature is very important to allow his big, beautiful brain to heal, Amanda McWerter said in the update. Please keep praying for our big-hearted, beautiful boy. She wrote, He needs that more than anything right now. The Anamosa Wrestling Club posted Thursday on Facebook asking members to contribute donations for a hospital goodie basket for the McWerter family and to send cards and other words of encouragement. The well-being of our AWC family members is at the core of what makes our AWC family so special, the wrestling club posted. In times of joy, we celebrate together, and in times of sorrow, we lean on each other for support. McWerters are facing an unimaginable situation, and we need to rally together to offer our collective support and solidarity. And the corrections, wrong ID. Kathy Pudzuvelis was misidentified in the Tosca costuming photo in Thursday's hoopla because of incorrect information supplied to the Gazette. The Gazette welcomes comments about the accuracy, fairness, and completeness of news articles, headlines, and captions in the newspaper. If the content is found to be wrong or misleading, a correction or clarification will be published in this space. Please call 319-398-8313 or 1-800-397-8212. Continuing on to the third page, the top article is titled "Medical Board Considers Tweaks to Abortion Rules." The law outlawing most abortions in Iowa remains tied up in court. It has a photo of a group of people in a large beige room sitting on desks with microphones looking up at a sort of smart board with a Zoom meeting on it being displayed. There is a Iowa state flag in the corner and a woman standing up recording the event with her phone. It's captioned, "Iowa physicians and residents speak January 4th during a public hearing in Des Moines held by the Iowa Board of Medicine. The state's medicine board gathered feedback as it considers rules for the implementation of a new state law currently tied up in court that would ban most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy." Article by Caleb McCullough for the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Des Moines, Iowa's Board of Medicine suggested changes Friday to the proposed rules to carry out an Iowa law that bans abortions early in pregnancy, while the law remains blocked as the Iowa Supreme Court weighs its constitutionality. The law bans abortion once cardiac activity is detected in an embryo or fetus, which can be as early as 6 weeks. It includes exceptions for rape and incest and medical emergencies. Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, signed the law last year after it was passed by legislative Republicans in a special session. A Polk County District Court judge temporarily blocked this law shortly after its passage this summer, but allowed the rulemaking process to move forward. Board members recommended a number of changes to the proposed rules after gathering feedback in a public hearing last week, where physicians raised concerns about the requirements placed on them and the impact on recruitment for OBGYNs in the state. During a board meeting Friday, members expressed some hesitation about requiring physicians who obtain information to determine whether a pregnancy is the result of a rape or incest. According to the draft rule, physicians intending to perform an abortion after cardiac activity is detected must gather certain facts to determine whether the pregnancy was a result of a rape or incest. Those questions include the relationship between the patient and the perpetrator, whether the act constituted a rape under Iowa code when the sex act occurred, and whether the act was first reported to a separate agency or an individual. Board members worried that doctors would have a hard time verifying those facts and said the questions generally are not within the scope of a general doctor's visit. My personal sentiment for really all of the rules is to try to adopt a set of rules that, to the extent possible, minimizes interference, delay, or undue extras into the physician-patient relationship to the extent possible, said board member Jason Myers. The board recommended changing the rules to indicate that a physician needs to use the information in their determination, but does not need to ask the patient each question in person. Some board members suggested the information could be obtained by a nurse or submitted on a form before the visit. Iowa Deputy Attorney General Leif Olson also said there is no burden on a physician to verify claims of rape or incest with a third party. According to rules, doctors may rely on a good faith assessment that the information provided by the pregnant woman is accurate. If it's the sort of information that the physician would typically rely on, that the patient were telling them the truth and in good faith they think that the patient is doing so, they can proceed without having to call and get independent information, copies of other third-party documents to back up the woman's story, he told the board. The board recommended including in the rules that a parent or legal guardian could attest to the facts about a rape or incest in the cases of abortion, rather than just the pregnant person. Board members said the change would make it more clear that a parent of a pregnant minor can provide the needed information to a physician in order to obtain an Board members said the change would make it more clear that a parent of a pregnant minor can provide the needed information to a physician in order to obtain an exception to the abortion ban. Following the text of the law, the proposed rules refer to the pregnant person throughout as a woman. The board proposed extending the definition of woman in the rules to include a minor female child. Olson said laws governing abortion have historically used the term woman to refer to the pregnant person, but they have been understood to mean both adults and minors. Doctors on the board, though, said the language does not match the medical terminology they generally use and wanted to clarify the rules. Board members also proposed defining the term unborn child as embryo or fetus. The law uses the term unborn child to refer to an embryo or fetus from the time of conception to birth, but the board member said that is not the term used in medical practice. The board also recommended changing the type of ultrasound required by doctors to determine whether cardiac activity is present in a pregnancy. The law and draft rules use the term abdominal ultrasound, but board member Robert Donnelly, an OBGYN, said an abdominal ultrasound is not what doctors use to determine a fetal heartbeat. Instead, he said the rules should require a transabdominal pelvic ultrasound. Excuse me. If you order an abdominal ultrasound, then you're not going to get the pelvic structure, he said, so you're not going to get the uterus and ovaries and that sort of thing. The Board of Medicine will vote on the amended rules at a later date. If approved, they will go before the state legislature's Administrative Rules Review Committee. If the committee does not object to the rules, they will become law after 35 days. Because of the injunction on the law, though, the rules could not be enforceable unless the court allows the law to go forward. Beneath this article is one titled, Iowa AG Appeals Court Ruling Halting Iowa Law on School Books. Byrd argues law passed last year is clear, by Tom Barton for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Republican Attorney General Brenna Byrd on Friday filed notice of appeal of a federal district court's decision to halt implementation of a law signed last year that bans books from school libraries that have descriptions or visual depictions of a list of sex acts. When we send our kids to school, we trust that their innocence will be protected, Byrd said in a statement. Iowa's law is clear. Sexually explicit books and materials have no place in our elementary school classrooms or libraries. As a mom, I share parents' concerns and remain committed to keeping our schools a safe place for kids to learn and grow. With this appeal, we will continue to fight to protect Iowa families and to uphold Iowa's law in court. The law was challenged by the ACLU of Iowa, the publishing company Penguin Random House Publishing, 16 LGBTQ students in Iowa, the LGBTQ advocacy organization Iowa Safe Schools, and the Iowa State Education Association Teachers Union on the grounds that it violates their First Amendment rights to free speech. The lawsuit argues books being removed from school under the age-appropriate standard are not pornography and fail to meet the definition of obscenity as determined by the U.S. Supreme Court. The suit argues the law prohibits books with even a brief description of a sex act for students of all ages without any evaluation of the book as a whole or its literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. In his order blocking the law until litigation is settled, U.S. District Court Judge Stephen Walker called the law wildly overbroad. The sweeping restrictions in Senate File 496 are unlikely to satisfy the First Amendment under any standard of scrutiny, thus may not be enforced while the case is pending, Walker wrote. The judge noted the law has resulted in removal of hundreds of books, including, among others, nonfiction history books, classic works of fiction, Pulitzer Prize-winning contemporary novels, and even books designed to help students avoid being victimized by sexual assault. The law also prohibits the teaching of gender identity and sexual orientation through sixth grade. Locker wrote, the law defines those terms in generic terms, meaning it would apply to the teaching of all gender identity and sexual orientation, not just when it pertains to LGBTQ individuals. The statute is therefore content neutral, but so wildly overbroad that every school district and elementary school teacher in the state has likely been violating it since the day the school year started, he wrote. Pat Grassley responds. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, R/New Hartford, said this week House Republicans may pass additional legislation to clarify or expand on the new law. I can't wrap my head around how the issue of sexually explicit material in schools got so convoluted, Grassley said Monday during his opening day speech, laying out House Republicans' priorities for the 2024 legislative session. I'm still shocked that we actually have people willing to fight this hard to keep pornographic material in our schools, Grassley said. What is the educational value of oral sex scenes in school library books? I'm completely confused and disturbed by this being the case. Last session, we passed a simple solution to protect Iowa students from inappropriate material. It should have been an easy policy for schools to implement, but instead, some chose to politicize this issue. If we need to pass additional legislation this session, we will. Administrative rules. Opponents of the law also say the proposed administrative rules do not go far enough to clarify the intent of the legislation and would lead to far too many books being removed from school library shelves. The rules clarify that a reference or mention of a sex act in a way that does not describe or visually depict the act is not prohibited from school libraries. The rules also apply only to a library that a school has direct control over, and schools with libraries that serve multiple grades must ensure that students have access only to material appropriate for their grades. On the portion of the law prohibiting instruction on gender and sexual orientation, the department stipulated that a neutral statement regarding sexual orientation or gender identity does not violate the rules. The rules state a school board would receive a written warning on the first violation and on the second violation. The superintendent and employees of the school could receive disciplinary action. Excuse me. Continuing to Nation and World on the fourth page. Winter storm pummels much of northern U.S., article by the Associated Press. St. Louis. A massive winter storm swept the northern U.S. on Friday with blinding snow in some places, freezing rain in others, and bitter cold temperatures and whipping winds across several states. A man was believed dead after an avalanche in the Idaho backcountry. A Wisconsin man died while snow blowing his driveway. Political leaders in Illinois implored Texas Governor Greg Abbott to stop sending migrants to Chicago, which is on the verge of dangerous weather. Heavy snow and strong winds made driving virtually impossible in parts of Iowa, so much so that Republican presidential hopefuls called off campaign events. Black ice from freezing rain caused wrecks and brought Kansas City, Missouri to a standstill. Flight cancellations were common, including more than 1,000 at Chicago's airports. In Idaho, two men were rescued after being caught in the avalanche Thursday afternoon near the Montana border, but a third man was missing and presumed dead. The U.S. Air Force assisted in a search and rescue. Authorities weren't sure what the men were doing in the area that had been under an avalanche danger warning for several days. The Idaho avalanche came a day after the first U.S. avalanche death of the season was reported in California on Wednesday. The Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office said Friday afternoon that it was investigating the death of a 69-year-old man who became unresponsive while snow blowing his driveway in Franklin, a Milwaukee suburb. No further information was released. Blizzard warnings were issued in some places, including southwestern Minnesota and the Green Bay area of Wisconsin. Forecasts for the Milwaukee area predicted heavy snow stretching into the morning, with wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour. The cold was the bigger concern in the Dakotas. It was 11 degrees below zero in Bliss marked North Dakota on Friday morning, and forecasters warned the weekend will get even worse. It could reach 20 below by early Sunday. Chicago is expecting several inches of snow through the weekend with wind chills well below zero. Advocates worried for the growing population of migrants sent up from the U.S.-Mexico border. More than 26,000 have arrived since last year. By Friday, dozens were staying in 8 parked warming buses to avoid sleeping outside while they await space in shelters. Angelo Travieso, I believe. Travieso, I hope I'm saying that right. A Venezuelan bussed up from Texas wore a light jacket and sandals with socks after sleeping on one of the buses. I slept sitting because there is almost no space left, he said. The buses are also small and you practically have to stay inside because of the heating, because it is deadly cold outside. Mayor Brandon Johnson said the city will suspend plans to enforce a 60-day cap on shelter stays for asylum seekers through at least January 2022. Because of the cold snap. Meanwhile, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker released a letter pleading with Abbott, as we grapple with the existing challenges of your ongoing manufactured crisis, the next few days are a threat to the families and children you are sending here, Pritzker wrote. I am pleading with you to at least pause these transports to save lives. Temperatures were below zero across Montana on Friday morning, with wind chills as low as minus 57 in places along the eastern edge of the Rocky Mountains and in the central part of the state. At the Double Cross Cattle Company, a ranch near Roberts, Montana, Tyson Robb used an axe to chop through inches of ice covering a stock tank so that his bulls could drink water. He used a feed truck to spread extra hay for his cows, a process he planned to repeat later Friday. Temperatures were expected to drop overnight to 28 below zero, so Ropp said he'd spread straw on the ground, somewhere out of the wind, for the cattle to rest and stay dry. Other areas in the Northeast had flooding concerns. Emergency responders helped evacuate residents from their homes in Paterson, New Jersey, early Friday at the Passaic River, started overflowing its banks. The new storm, combined with one earlier in the week, created flooding worries in Maine and New Hampshire, too. The South wasn't immune. Several storms with winds reaching 70 miles per hour stretched across Mississippi. Arctic air is expected to arrive in the South by this weekend. The Mississippi Emergency Management Agency urged residents to prepare for ice, frigid temperatures, and possible prolonged power outages. Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry declared a state of emergency Friday in anticipation of temperature plunging over the weekend, with a chance of sleet and snow early next week. To the right of this article in a column is Johnson says he's sticking to budget deal, but no plan to stop partial shutdown, article by the Associated Press. Washington. House Speaker Mike Johnson insisted Friday he is sticking with the bipartisan spending deal he struck with the other congressional leaders, but offered no clear path for overcoming hard right opposition within his own party to prevent a partial government shutdown next week. Johnson emerged from days of testy meetings behind closed doors at the Capitol to read a terse statement. Just months on the job, the new speaker is trying to set the record straight that he will not renege on the budget deal he made earlier this week. But in his first big test as the new leader, he has yet to show how he will quell the revolt from his right flank that ousted his predecessor. "Our top line agreement remains," Johnson said, referring to the budget accord reached January 7th. "We are getting our next steps together, and we are working toward a robust appropriations process," he said. "So stay tuned for all that." It's the same intractable dilemma that led a core group of right-flank Republicans to boot Republican Kevin McCarthy from the Speaker's office last year as they revolted against the deal he struck with the other congressional leaders and that President Joe Biden signed into law. Lawmakers during the next work week of the first new year are furious that after spending much of 2023 watching hard right Republicans fight the leaders, they are careening toward another crisis with just a week to go before the January 19th deadline to fund parts of the government. At the bottom page, an article titled "Texas Blocking U.S. Border Agents from Patrols, White House Asks Supreme Court to Intervene," article by the Associated Press. And I apologize, I forgot to mention for the winter storm article, there are two photos. One is of an interstate covered in snow with a few cars going down it. There's a sign above the interstate that reads "Hazardous travel conditions, travel not advised." And then below this is a photo of a man with some sort of blower clearing his a sidewalk. He's wearing lots of layers. He's walking by a road. The one with the highway is captioned "Signs along Highway 75 looking south from F Street advise against travel due to snow Friday in Omaha, Nebraska." And then one of the men is captioned "Kenny Austin uses a leaf blower to clear snow Friday as temperatures hovered at 23 below zero in Helena, Montana." Back to the article, again titled "Texas Blocking U.S. Border Agents from Patrols, White House Asks Supreme Court to Intervene," article by the Associated Press. McAllen, Texas. The Justice Department on Friday asked the Supreme Court to order Texas to stop blocking Border Patrol agents from a portion of the U.S.-Mexico border where large numbers of migrants have crossed in recent months, setting up another showdown between Republican Governor Greg Abbott and the Biden administration over immigration enforcement. The request comes after Texas put up fencing to take control of a nearly 50-acre public park along the Rio Grande and Eagle Pass, which was a crossing point for thousands of migrants entering from Mexico last year. Although a similar power struggle played out in the same region more than a year ago, the area Texas closed off this week prevents federal agents from accessing a larger and more visible crossing point spot. Along one stretch, armed Texas National Guard members and their vehicles are preventing Border Patrol agents from accessing the river, the Justice Department said in a court filing. The Texas National Guard also allegedly used a military Humvee to keep Border Patrol agents off an access road. Because Border Patrol can no longer access or view this stretch of the border, Texas has effectively prevented Border Patrol from monitoring the border, the Justice Department wrote in a filing. Abbott told reporters that Texas has the authority to control access to any geographic location in the state. The authority is being asserted, Abbott said. The closure of Shelby Park was an escalation of the governor's border enforcement efforts known as Operation Lone Star. The state and federal government are involved in multiple legal disputes over actions Texas has taken since 2023, including the use of buoys in the middle of the International River, the installment of razor wire, and an upcoming law that will allow police to arrest migrants. Abbott defended closing off the park as he faced backlash from Democrats for telling conservative radio host Dana Loesch last week that Texas has done everything to curb illegal crossing short of shooting people. Loesch has asked Abbott how far Texas could go on the border before someone might arrest him. The only thing that we're not doing is we're not shooting people who come across the border because, of course, the Biden administration would charge us with murder, he said as he discussed a New York City lawsuit against charter bus companies that he was used to transport migrants from Texas. Mexico's Foreign Relations Secretary denounced Abbott's comments, saying they could lead to violence and are dehumanizing to migrants. On Friday, Abbott said he was making a distinction of what Texas can and cannot do on the border. I was asked to point out where the line is drawn about what would be illegal, and I pointed out something that is obviously illegal, he said. Texas notified the Eagle Pass government on Wednesday that the Department of Public Safety would be closing public access to Shelby Park. Concern grew when Border Patrol noted it, too, lost access to the park, which agents used to launch boats into the Rio Grande. The area also served as a staging area where federal officers would take migrants' custody and process them. The Border Patrol's access to the site for surveillance was similarly curtailed. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Katie Davis. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Again, if you'd like to give us a call, call us at 515-243-6833. Thank you.